Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. It's been 40 years since the Watergate break-in and investigation that ultimately destroyed the presidency of Richard Nixon. I say 40 years because if you're, say, under 45 years of age, you have little knowledge of these events. If you're over 50, it's hard to believe it was that long ago. And while nearly all the principals of this national drama are deceased, are these the events that should be the subject of a historical novel? Well, my guest today said yes and has written a darkly comic view of the break-in and cover-up titled Watergate, a Novel. Thomas Mallon is the author of 8 novels, including Henry and Clara, Dewey Defeats Truman, and Fellow Travelers, and he's also written nonfiction works on plagiarism, the art of letter writing, and the Kennedy assassination. He contributes to The New Yorker, The New York Times Book Review, and was the literary editor of Gentleman's Quarterly. He won a National Book Critics Circle Award for his reviewing and directs the creative writing program at George Washington University in Washington, D.C. His 8th novel, Watergate, a Novel, was first published last year and is now out in softcover, and last month it was named as a finalist for the 2013 Penn Faulkner Award. Mallon tells his own revisionist story of the petty crime and cover-up from the viewpoint of as many as 10 of the over 50 characters in the events. And it's a good read for those of us who lived through the events through television in 1973 and 74. Thomas Mallon is my guest today. Thomas Mallon, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
This is a very interesting novel, darkly comic novel about Watergate. Now, when you write a novel about a historical event, usually you go back 2, 3, 4 generations. This is, you know, most of the principals are no longer with us, but you know, it's only been 40-something years. What intrigued you about writing about Watergate, and especially a novel?
Well, there's no real definition for when historical fiction becomes historical. People have proposed them. Some have even said, you know, 25 years, 50 years, whatever. But this, we're at about 40 years from Watergate, and I think that I wanted to try fiction with this enormous subject. I mean, it's got an enormous cast of characters. Because so many of the principal figures, as you say, are either gone, or whether or not they're gone, they've told their own stories in a shelf full of memoirs. Practically everybody who was involved in the Watergate catastrophe wrote a memoir of one kind or another, sometimes only to get money to pay their legal bills. And so you have this whole nonfiction literature about the scandal. But what I wanted to do, and I think what historical fiction wants to do generally, is try to get inside the heads of both the principals and some of the peripheral figures who have interesting angles on it. You know, a biographer can always say things like, well, at this moment in the crisis, it is not unreasonable to suppose that Nixon may have thought, dot, dot, dot. The novelist just goes ahead and has him think it.
No. That's right. And you mentioned this cast of characters. We're talking 4 pages of characters that show up in the book, mm-hmm. everything from a glance to there are multiple narrators in the course of this. We sort of have an internal monologue with a number of the characters, everybody from the president and the first lady to the Watergate bagman to Howard Hunt, who's wondering why the heck he's doing this cut-rate burglary in the first place and mm-hmm. sort of saying, well, this might get my career out of the toilet.
Hunt was the only one of the figures that I knew. I actually saw Mr. and Mrs. Nixon come through my town when I was 16 years old, when he was running for president in 1968, the second time he ran. But Hunt was somebody that I knew about 20 years ago. In those days, I was the literary editor at Gentleman's Quarterly at Condé Nast in New York. I used to buy the fiction. I used to write book reviews. I used to commission essays. And I had met him in a peculiar way at an alumni event, a commencement weekend, at our mutual alma mater, Brown University. And Hunt had gone there in the 40s. I'd gone there in the 70s. In fact, I was graduating right as Watergate was exploding in the spring of 73. And Hunt, in addition to being a spy, in addition to working for the CIA, had a long career writing spy novels. And I was introduced to him at a party, and when it came time back in New York at my job to get somebody to write about Norman Mailer's big spy novel, Harlot's Ghost, which was coming out at that point, I got in touch with Howard. And he wrote a long and actually quite good piece for the magazine. And so I got to know him a little bit. He used to write me lots of notes. Saw him a couple of times in New York, I think. And he, of course, now, you know, 20 years later, when I was writing the novel, I was kicking myself thinking, why didn't I ask him all about the Watergate business, which we never touched on more than a time or two.
Right. And of course, at that point, it was probably bad taste.
probably. He, you know, he had had, I mean, historical fiction always winds up distorting the characters. And in some ways, I think you get a truer picture of them than you get in history because the license allows you to get deeper inside them. But also, there are the inevitable distortions and misunderstandings of fiction. And Howard, in the book, I think he's portrayed quite sympathetically, but he would probably not recognize certain aspects of himself. I think that's the nature of fiction, and to some extent, it's the nature of nonfiction, just journalism, profile writing. People so rarely see themselves on the page when they've been depicted.
Now, you mentioned you graduated at the time Watergate happened. Was this something that you were glued to at the time? Or
completely.
Yeah, no. I mean, I was about to be a teenager, and I was sort of glued to it, mainly because in those days there was only three television channels, and everybody was playing the hearings all summer.
It was enormously complex, and the country really paid attention, too. The country really got caught up in it. In the details of it, and it was both a print story and a television story. It was, of course, pre-internet. Nixon would have loved the internet. But it was, to a great extent, of course, a newspaper story, the Washington Post being out in front of the story for much of the time. But it was also a TV story at crucial points. During the summertime, both the summer of 73 and 74, in 73 you had Senator Irvin's Senate hearings, into Watergate, and then in 74
you had the impeachment.
The House, exactly, the impeachment hearings from the Judiciary Committee. So it really commanded news media. I mean, if you go back to, say, Time magazine in those days, Time magazine was an enormously more central publication than it is today. You know, you could scarcely find a week during that period when there wasn't a Watergate cover.
And it's interesting, 40 years on, even as I was reading through the book, you know, how many of these details blurred over those 40 years? We forget the enormity of the cast, the Cuban burglars. Another character we meet early on is Fred LaRue, who is this sort of type of character that historical fiction, if there's not a real person, they'll always create a person like this. It's the guy who has no title, who fixes things. He's a fixer, really, in many cases. And he was known as the Watergate bagman because he's the guy who paid off people to keep them quiet after the burglary was discovered. But you do this whole section on Fred LaRue, and it must have been a lot of fun just sort of reconstructing who this person was, because he is this ultimate Washington fixer who's got a little bit of shady past. He's got he's shady in the present, and
and, you know, and for all that, he too has a sympathetic side, the way that Howard did. He appealed to me a lot when I would watch these old documentaries and clips, and there was a softness to the way he spoke. There was a gentleness to him. He really loved John Mitchell, who was Nixon's rough, tough attorney general and campaign manager, for whom LaRue did a lot of that fixing. But LaRue clearly had an emotional sense of the tremendous toll that the scandal took on Mitchell. I mean, it essentially destroyed Mitchell's life and career. And he, too, you know, for all of the nefarious things he had gotten into, struck me as very human and somebody with whom a reader could sympathize. And I think as a novelist, you're always looking for that.
And his history is really interesting because his father was actually been convicted of some scam and later discovered oil, became rich. And he and Fred were on a hunting trip, and all of a sudden he's shot in a hunting accident.
Right, which sort of...
it's this air of mystery.
Exactly. And, I mean, people knew that. They were aware of that. And they it contributed to this air of mystery. You know, that along with the fact that he seemed to have no fixed location in the White House or, you know, business card or appearance in the White House directory, but he was available for task, and the big task that came to him in Watergate was acting as the go-between and getting the money from the White House paymasters and the campaign to the burglars. Like a lot of the principals in the story, he lived at the Watergate. You know, the Watergate is what we call a mixed-use complex. It's got a couple of office buildings in it, and that's where the Democrats had their party headquarters.
There's a hotel.
Burgled. There's a hotel, which is now being renovated, and then there are a few condo complexes. And LaRue lived at the Watergate. Attorney General Mitchell and Mrs. Mitchell lived at the Watergate. Rosemary Woods, the president's secretary, had an apartment in Watergate West. I kind of expected to be in and out of the complex when I started the book. I sort of expected to be like the burglars, make a quick run in an early chapter and then leave. But the narrative would take me back inside from time to time because that's where some of them were living.
Now, the whole thing about the Watergate, it was a cover-up that brought down the Nixon administration. But what were they actually after in burglarizing the Democratic National Headquarters? What did they expect to I mean, in your book, the Cuban exiles that are doing the actual burglary, they think they're going to find money coming up from Fidel Castro to finance the Democrats.
It's really an enduring mystery who actually ordered them into the Watergate and what exactly they thought they were looking for. This has never been fully answered to this day. The Watergate was listed as a target very early on when Gordon Liddy presented his plans for campaign espionage early in 1972. But why, when we get to the late spring, they actually decide to go forward and go in there and what they were looking for remains a matter of great dispute. And there's, you know, just as the Kennedy assassination has its grassy knoll theorists and people who see dark and extremely complicated conspiracy views of it, have a whole alternative history of it, Watergate has that too. And there are a lot of Watergate buffs who, you know, present an entirely different scenario for what went on and why it actually happened. I mean, my book, in most respects, follows the historical timeline, and it follows the biggest historical explanations with one conspicuous difference, a kind of comic accident, which winds up relating the tragedy in Fred LaRue's past to what's going on in the current political wars.
Yeah. The thing to remember, though, is that 1968 was an incredibly close election. You had Humphrey, you had Wallace. Wallace siphoned votes from Nixon, and it was a very close election. But by the time the summer comes around of 72, Wallace has been shot. He's obviously not going to run for president. The Democrats are running, from a Republican standpoint, the ideal candidate for them to stomp McGovern. You know, it looks like it's going to be a cakewalk, yet they go ahead and still do all this stuff.
Yeah, and this is for people sympathetic to Richard Nixon, you know, this is the great tragedy of the whole thing, that he was really at the peak of his accomplishments. I mean, I think even Nixon's worst enemies concede that he was a man of great gifts and had a kind of political vision for the United States' place in the world and, you know, had tremendous skills. But I think that he was so scarred by his two big political defeats, his loss to John F. Kennedy in 1960 and his loss of the governorship of California 2 years after that. I think that on top of just a very combative, bruising political personality, those things, as well as the whole contentious atmosphere of anti-war protest, which lingered throughout his first term as it had marked Lyndon Johnson's term, I think all of those things made him dig in, break the rules, and carry things so far when, as you say, it was so, quote, unnecessary. Things were going so well. So there's the tragic element of Watergate, that, you know, this needless catastrophe is brought upon a man who, to some extent, appears as if he can't help himself. Anybody who goes back over this story realizes that there are so many points at which, if he had not done A or B or C, or if he had fessed up and cut his losses at a certain point, it never would have come to the catastrophe that it did.
My guest today is Thomas Mallon, director of the Creative Writing Program at George Washington University, author of 8 books, novels as well as nonfiction. His new book is titled Watergate, a Novel. It came out last year. It's now out on softcover. And last month, it was a finalist for the Penn Faulkner Award. And he's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. Well, I want to talk about your portrayal of Richard and Pat Nixon, which is really an interesting, somewhat different take than most people have. But I have to ask about another character you included, and that is Alice Roosevelt Longworth. Mm-hmm. I had totally forgotten she was still alive in 1972.
Yes, she was she was 88 at that point and still very much on the scene, living in her mansion in DuPont Circle. She was Theodore Roosevelt's daughter. She'd come to Washington when her father became president in 1901. He'd been McKinley's vice president and became president upon McKinley's assassination. And Alice, whenever she was asked about this by biographers for decades later, when she was asked what was her reaction when she heard that McKinley had gone to his reward, she always said, "I danced a jig." She wanted to be the president's daughter no matter what the circumstances were. She was a beautiful young woman, got married in the White House, was very irrepressible. Roosevelt famously said that he could either run the country or control Alice, but not both. So he chose to run the country. And she married a man named Nicholas Longworth, who became the Speaker of the House of Representatives. There's the Longworth House office building.
Yes.
That always shows up in the news. That's named for him. And she was a great wit, extremely mischievous. I mean, she probably in life never really found a great cause to apply her intelligence to, the way her cousin Eleanor Roosevelt did. But she was famous for the things that she said, the sharp-tongued remarks that she made. And she was actually quite good friends with the Nixon family. She was a lifelong Republican. She marked Nixon as a real comer in politics from the time he arrived in Washington in the 1940s, and kept up with him all the time he was vice president, the years of his exile, and was a guest fairly often at the Nixon White House when she was quite an old lady. So she, in the book, she becomes sort of my one-woman witches chorus. And she has this long historical memory and, as I say, this sharp tongue, and she comments on the action and, to some extent, is a participant in it.
Yeah, and she's a delightful wit. The thing she's famous for saying must have gave you a lot of ammunition to play with in this book.
Right. She's the woman who said that Calvin Coolidge looked as if he had been weaned on a pickle. She actually didn't say, although it's always attributed to her, that Thomas E. Dewey looked like the little man on the wedding cake.
Right.
You know, she was always good copy for the newspapers. Whenever she had a birthday, the Washington papers would go and interview her, and she would talk about, you know, both the past and the present. But she was much more. I've known a couple of people who knew her, and I talked with them about her, and they agree that she much preferred to talk about what was in the newspapers to what was in the history books. And so I think she was pretty avid following Watergate, even at her very advanced age. The Nixons even show up at her 90th birthday party in February of 1974. That's only about 6 months before the president resigns, and they make the trip from the White House to her DuPont Circle mansion and join the guests there in what's an incredibly tense atmosphere, because by that point Nixon is really at war with everybody, the Congress, the press, so forth.
You know, it's interesting that, in fact, after Watergate, Alice did break with the Nixons and with the Republican Party, and a lot of had to do with something Nixon said after he left office, in which he paraphrased a quote by Theodore Roosevelt, her father, in which he said, you know, you have to experience the bitterest lows to mm-hmm. experience the mountaintop, which was Theodore Roosevelt's comment after a personal tragedy. And here he was applying it to his political fortunes. And I think that broke it forever.
Right. She thought that this was very strange, and that he would quote from her father's diary about the death of her mother, Roosevelt's
yeah.
first wife,
mm-hmm.
And use it in this way. I changed this around in the book. This incident, I give it a kind of secret underpinning, which gives it a kind of different explanation. Highly unlikely that it actually happened the way I have it. but like a lot of historical fiction, not completely beyond the, you know, the realm of plausibility. But I chose Alice for this part. People sometimes ask me, why not Martha Mitchell? People who remember Watergate remember Attorney General Mitchell's wife, Martha, was a very flamboyant Southerner.
Absolutely out of control at this point with her alcoholism and everything. She really was. And you depict that honestly in the book, I think.
And that really was why the alcoholism, most of all, was why Martha, who could be very entertaining, and the press, she wore out her welcome, but the press for a while really, you know, loved quoting her and following her. But unlike Alice, who did not like hard drinkers, Martha really did drink and was in very bad shape, and she just didn't have the kind of perspective on everything that would have allowed me to use her the way I was able to use Alice to get perspective.
Now, I want to talk, you're very sympathetic to Pat Nixon, I think, for the most part, and Richard Nixon shows up a little differently than we expect. He's not as nearly as paranoidal and you know, all the attributes we think of Nixon. I thought it was an interesting portrayal of Nixon.
Well, thank you. I mean, I didn't see any point in portraying Nixon as some two-dimensional, you know, cardboard villain. I mean, for one thing, I don't see him that way. I see him as a very complicated man, full of flaws, but also full of, you know, considerable gifts.
You see his insecurities. You definitely see the insecurities of him, but it's not, you know, it isn't a caricature, which that's sort of the image we have of him in the White House, especially in that second term.
And Mrs. Nixon was always caricatured as, you know, they used to call her Plastic Pat, and she was the perfect, dutiful political wife, was extremely quiet. I mean, there many people can't recall what Mrs. Nixon sounded like because she spoke so little while they were in the White House, even though she was a very familiar figure. She'd been on the political scene, you know, for decades. But I sort of thought that there was more to her, too. And clearly there was devotion and loyalty between the two of them, and I wanted to portray that, even as I, probably the most controversial thing that I did in the novel was, even though I imagine Mrs. Nixon having had a brief love affair during the years that the Nixons were living in New York, between his defeats, after he lost the California governorship in 1962, they moved to New York, and they were there from 63 to 68. It was from New York that he launched his comeback that won him the presidency. And I imagine Mrs. Nixon during this period, which was one of the real happy parts of her life. They lived very quietly on Fifth Avenue. She went to museums and bookstores and Elizabeth Arden, and she got along very well with her girls who were in school, and she was out of the newspapers. She thought for a while that her husband actually might be out of politics, which was a life she did not like. And I sort of complete her happiness during that period by having her have this brief sort of 6 months affair with a very genial widower in New York, a fictional character that I call Tom Garahan. And she ends the affair, but she has a certain wistfulness about it. And those memories sustain her in some ways while she is standing by Richard Nixon during the Watergate catastrophe.
Yeah, she's thinking of New York.
And it's a funny business, you know, writing a book like this. There were a number of critics who were very nice to the book, really liked the book, but did not want to go there with this particular thing. They thought that this was crossing a line the way and novelists, historical novelists, are sometimes accused of doing that, the way comedians get accused of doing it. You know, well, it's too soon to do that, or you've gone too far by doing that. And I really felt that this was something that was okay, for lack of a better term, to do, because it so clearly has no malice in it. I mean, what I was trying to do was portray a much warmer, much fuller Pat Nixon than had ever appeared in any account of anything to do with her. And I, in a strange way, even though I was aware that I was making this up, when I was writing this part of the story, I somehow felt that I was getting closer to the essence of her personality and her emotions and her feelings. So in a way, and I think this is one of the things that novelists do generally, and maybe historical novelists do in particular, I was telling specific lies, inventing specific things in order to get at a bigger actual truth.
Yeah.
I don't know if I succeeded or not, but that's the modus operandi.
It seemed true to you at the time.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, I don't want to give away all the secrets, but we were talking about secrets of why this happened. But, of course, another crazy story was, you know, the big gaps in the tapes, in the Watergate mm-hmm. tapes. And Rosemary Woods is this very dutiful, sort of inwardly smoldering secretary, mm-hmm. Rosemary Woods, in your book, Watergate, a novel.
I take what was a genuine resentment she had against H.R. Haldeman, the president's chief of staff, who everybody remembers as that forbidding man with the crew cut, and I amplify that. And I again, invent one of those explanations as to why this might have happened. And the explanation is, which is frequently what happens in this book, the explanation for what turns out to be a big, important political catastrophe is often something small, personal, sometimes something humorous, sometimes that proceeds from an individual's vanity or just some kind of private compulsion.
A petty malice, I would say, is mm-hmm. the best way to describe it.
And I do think that there are, to some extent, history does operate that way. You can never really get rid of the human factor in history. And people's personal emotions rule them at one point or another. And fate plays a role. I think this is one of the reasons, too, why, even though in this book we do see a lot of the big figures, I mean, Nixon himself, Mrs. Nixon, Elliot Richardson, one of the cabinet officers.
Yes.
But you also see a lot of these minor figures, like Fred LaRue. I think that they've always appealed to me in writing fiction because the reader, again, can identify with them. They're not people on the scale of, say, a president of the United States. The reader can think, well, you know, with a few accidents, I might have wound up in that position. And I mean, when I wound up writing about Lincoln in a novel called Henry and Clara about 20 years ago, the book that I wrote was ultimately called Henry and Clara. And Henry and Clara were the couple
who shared the box.
Couple,
yeah.
Who were in the box at Ford's Theater.
Yeah.
And so I told the story of the Civil War and the decades after through all of the things that had happened to them as a result of their having been there that night.
No, that's really interesting. And it is a fun book, and you'll have to read it to know what happened to that in that 18-minute gap. The name of the book is Watergate, a novel. Thomas Mallon, thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks so much, Rich. Appreciate it.
Thomas Mallon directs the creative writing program at George Washington University and is the author of Watergate, a novel, which is now out in softcover from Vintage. Last month, it was named a finalist for the Pen Faulkner Award. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.